Welcome to Taking Responsibility for Torah, the podcast. This is intended as the final episode in our series on Mai Chazit Damidach Sumak Tvei, what have you seen that your blood is redder, as a first principle in halakha. Since last week's episode, sadly, was not recorded, I'll review that briefly and then we'll turn to our final topic. Beginning from the beginning, the Gemara says, and we've established that the Gemara says that this is something you have to know before you start interpreting Torah and learning halakha, that you have to know that you can't kill somebody else to save yourself, because who says that your blood is redder? We tried to apply that beyond the specific realm of murder in a number of cases. The first was talking about the question of triage, in which we argued that there might be times in which you can justify giving medical resources to one person over another, so long as that is not framed or thought of as this person's life is more worthwhile than that person's, but rather this is the best way to, the most efficient way to make use of medical resources. The second question that we applied this to was the question of brain death. Brain death seemingly involves killing the, right, if you assume that the brain dead patient is not dead, as I do, it seems to be taking the life of the donor in order to save the life of the recipient. And that seems in straightforward violation of one person's blood being redder than another. And the response to that was no. You can say that actually, the donor is actually being kept alive for the sake of donation, and you don't take the life for the sake of the recipient, you take the life for the sake of the donor. You delay taking the life of the donor for the sake of the recipient. And we talked about a recent protocol that seems to raise the question of whether that makes brain death a chumrah and raises the question of whether Orthodox Jews have to be careful about the means by which donated organs are acquired before accepting them. Last week, we tried to bring the question back to the beginning of life. We'd raised the question of whether halakha has anything to say about questions like eugenics. And then the question is, how do we distinguish between eugenics and choosing among embryos via PIGD, gene therapy, CRISPR, which might be able to resolve issues in the embryo of certain types of genetic diseases. And then we move from solving things that we all recognize as disease to simply improving things. We talked about improving memory, improving the capacity, removing the ability or diminishing the ability to accept white lies socially. Is one allowed to change the embryo in the womb to improve intelligence? Is there value in trying to or a prohibition in trying to improve the character of the of a potential child through genetic intervention? So it might be that the answer to all these questions is obviously no, we have no problem with it halakhically at all. But historically, in the past two centuries at least, since the past century, partially or even largely because it seems that Nazi Germany was very into eugenics, eugenics has acquired a bad taste, and there seems to be an intuition in the halachic community that, or at least in the general community of which the halachic community is a part, maybe I haven't polled the halachic community specifically, that simply allowing eugenics broadly would be a bad idea, but maybe that's just because the technology isn't sufficiently developed for us to be able to know that there won't be unwanted consequences that were actually harming the children, as was raised in the case of the children in China who were genetically altered to be more resistant to COVID, but we don't know what the other consequences of changing specific aspects of their genome are. So I tried to develop a thesis that would say that when you're doing it for the sake of the fetus, because otherwise the fetus, we would say perhaps, has no interest in living, as in cases of Tay-Sachs children and things like that. That would not be making a claim that some lives are more valuable than others. Raise the question whether PIGD is the same or different. When choosing among embryos is different than improving a specific embryo. I tried to argue that a core test would be right, whether you would be willing to accept the, right, would you be willing to carry the trial to term if the, right, if the proposed change didn't take? Because if you wouldn't be challenged, willing to carry the trial to term, if the proposed change didn't take, then you were in fact saying that life B is more valuable to, or life of type B is more valuable to you than life type A, but with provisos. There are situations where you might have a genuine subjective need for one kind of trial over another, for example, to fulfill the mitzvah of Purvu. Deborah pushed back very, very hard against that, the notion, because I suggested that we might end up with some kind of equivalent of a Grumma switch, where we would say you can do it, but only if you acknowledge that there's a realistic chance, a chance beyond the level of Shomer Psaim Hashem, that your change won't take, and you're prepared to carry the child anyway. Deborah thought any such even thought experiment was cruel, and I think that I need to refine the argument further. Although I still think that it's a useful framework for thinking about which sort of changes we should allow or not, that we can only allow changes in a context where we're not making a claim that some lives are more valuable than others, recognizing that this is a deep challenge because we cure illnesses, right? Presumably because we think that it's better for the person to live this kind of life. How we distinguish between doing things for people, between praising people for moral actions and nonetheless saying that their lives are still intrinsically have some kind of shared equal value, and you can't use one in the content formulation as a means for the other, I think that still requires more work than I successfully accomplished last week. I didn't get to last week, but I want to introduce now that in the context of eugenics, there's a possibility of a different first principle, which my teacher, Rabbi J. David Bleich, proposed, I think simply because he could not, because he really feels that eugenics must be wrong. There's a Gemara right, the Gemara on Brachos 10a, which is seems to be central to this, which the Gemara records a dialogue between Chizkiah HaMelech and Yeshayah HaNavi, in which Yeshayah comes and tells him, "You're going to right." This is an expansion of a right of Tanakh. Yeshayah comes and tells it to him, "Ko Amar Hashem Tzal Levitcha Ki Meitzat Tavlo Tzichya." Right, you write your will, right? Give your last commands because you're going to die and not live. And the answer, and Chizkiah turns to him and says, "Why?" And Yeshayah says, "Because you have not engaged in prayer of river. You don't yet have children." And Chizkiah says, "But I have seen Baruch HaKodesh, that if I have children, they'll turn out to be evil." And in fact, Menashe ben Chizkiah turns out to be the worst of kings, although he does tshuva at the end, and that complicates the whole question. To what extent is that the relevant issue? And Yeshayah tells him, "Hadei kavshei d'rachman alach. What do you have to do with these secrets of God? What you're commanded, you're required to do." Now, not all versions of the Gemara have that line precisely, that it rests on commandedness. You have two different kinds of analyses, one of which focus on the there being certain sorts of information that either you should not have access to, or even if you have access to, you should not act upon. And right, the second version, which says, no, it's not access to information, it's not acting on the access to the information, it's when acting on access to the information is in conflict with something you are commanded to do, that we have an issue. Other than that, there's no problem. So we talked, right? So there are Rishonim who think that the whole issue is the kind of knowledge is kafshei d'rachmana, but any knowledge that you gain through natural means is fine, and you're entitled to act upon that. As a reverse position, which is a simple reading of Rashi, which is that you simply should engage in all actions naively, but that has to have a limit also. Rav Moshe Feinstein puts that limit in terms of Tesach testing. He says that, you know, you're supposed to have faith in God, so don't think about the future, just trust God, but you still look down when you're walking along to make sure you don't fall into pits. That would be right. That would be absurd to say that you're supposed to walk with your eyes up so you can fall into pits. And he says that not having genetic testing for Tesach before you're married, to know whether, right, so we have both sides tested so that we can avoid matches that lead to a 25% chance of Tay-Sachs infants. Rav Moshe says that right, not having that testing would be the equivalent of not looking down to avoid falling into pits. That's actually a very, very long way to move. So where do we end up? Right, we have access to lots of information. It's not is not supernatural. There's a contradiction in the Meiri, or at least Meiri does not see it as a contradiction, but when I read it, it seemed to me pretty astonishing that he could say these two things simultaneously. I'll read you the Meiri, and you can decide for yourself whether you think that there is a fundamental difficulty. Meiri says, to Sanhedrin Samach Zayin Amud Bet, anything that you do by natural means, kol shenasa, or anything that is done by natural means, right? Eino b'chlal kshafim. That's not considered witchcraft, so there's nothing, right? Nothing scientific is forbidden. Even if you know how to create beautiful creatures without sexuality, as is known, he says in the books of natural philosophy, that this is not impossible. You can do it because, right, at least there's no violation of witchcraft in creating beautiful beings without sexuality. Okay. Let's now talk about how he shifts to human beings. Okay, he says, Mitzvah aseh shel periyah v'reviyah, ein la'adam lefkiya al shem shuchot shedet atzmo u'bat zugo shel halo zer hagun. You should not abrogate the mitzvah of puravu because you're afraid that you or your mate will not have proper children. So that sounds directly drawn, right, obviously from Chizkiah, and it's based on that Gemara. Whether he says im al pi hashmua, im al pi hasechel, im al pi hanisayon, right? This prohibition against, or at least this discouragement, this claim that the obligation supersedes this applies no matter how you get right, no matter how this suspicion develops, whether it's through tradition or through reason or through experience. She'ein l'adam etzel sisrei Hashem klum, because a human being has nothing to do with the secrets of God. U'kemo she'amru b'adei kav she'rachman olam alach, as the Gemara says. But then Miri adds, u'mikol makom, yishtadel b'zivugo, b'ma she'ru'i li'yishtadel b'vad zug, right, you should seek out a spouse, you should seek out all the things that are appropriate to seek in your mate. K'mit kavein b'zivugo l'huledet b'nim hagudim. Right, like someone whose intention is to have proper children. As a Gemara example, so right, check out relatives, and check out parents and household and all those sorts of things. So how do we deal with this? On the one hand, you're supposed to just have faith, and on the other hand, the theory is correct. Do we think that we don't assign marriages through random selection, and we also don't encourage people to marry solely on the basis of sexual attraction? So how do we square a claim that you're not right, that you're not supposed to fail to engage in puravu because of suspicion, and yet when you engage it, you should try your best. So we could say simple solution to Miri is that when you're seeking a mate, you should seek a mate which has the greatest likelihood of having banim hagunim. But if it turns out you made an error, you should not refrain from puravu because of that error. I guess that's possible, although I guess that's possible, right? That's a plausible reading of the Meiri. So I try to argue that really Meiri is making a difference between the who and the how. That at the level of whether, when you're talking about whether to bring human beings as a whole into being, you can do whatever you want in order to arrange that. But when you have a choice as to who to bring into being, or a choice as to whether to bring a specific human being into being, that is very dangerous, because that seems to suggest that some lives are more valuable than others. I wanted to frame the Meiri in that regard, that when the choice is expressed explicitly whether to bring a human being into being or not, and you're making that decision not on criteria that are relevant to the being that, right, you know, that this right, you want to improve it so the being will have a better life, but rather you're saying this being is not worth bringing into being, and right, this feed and that one is, so that prima facie is a violation of whose blood is redder principle. There are ways to transform it, as there were by triage and by brain death, but you can demonstrate in some way that you're not making an objective claim about the value of the potential child, but making a subjective claim. So puravu is an example of that. that I need to have a girl because I had a boy, but that doesn't mean that girls are more valuable than boys. It could be that there are other ways in which you could demonstrate a subjective need. I tried to say you could demonstrate that it was subjective by showing that you're willing to bring a child into being the other way also. Deborah objected to that. Okay, Rabbi Bleich took a very different approach. Rabbi Bleich argued that the fundamental problem is playing God. Now, where you draw the line about what constitutes playing God and what doesn't, that's a separate question. But he thought that eugenics, per se, the notion of always trying to produce, to scientifically arrange for the best possible child, that is a violation of playing God. Now, the standard he set out is as follows. He said that there is a Gemara which says, takes from the Pasuk, Verapo Yerape, in Parashat Mishpatim, that teaches us that the doctor has permission to heal. So Rabbi Bleich argued that if the doctor needs permission to heal, that means that there's a prior premise, what I call a first principle, that human beings should not interfere with the order of creation. And healing is an exception, right? This is a question that has been dealt with theologically all through Jewish history. Why should you be allowed to heal? If God made you ill, God must intend you to be ill. And of course, God can heal. And the Ramban thinks perhaps that in the ideal world, you would just pray and medicine is a concession. How strongly the Ramban means that or whether, I could see people arguing about that. But Rabbi Leif wanted to argue that even though we have, of course, greatly expanded the range of medical capacity over the past few centuries, but it doesn't change the notion that you should only engage in these things when they can be defined as healing. Therefore, he argued that genetic mutations that take somebody who is already a perfectly ordinary human being and make them better are not allowed in the context of, because they're a violation of, they're a violation of playing God. You can ask obvious questions about this. How does it relate to the plastic surgery? Isn't plastic surgery taking somebody who's perfectly healthy? And reader of Moshe has the heter because you're seeking out marriage, so it's not actually an attempt to improve the person. Maybe I wanted to argue that perhaps you could combine Rabbi Bleich's idea with some notion that the concept of kilayim, the various prohibitions of kilayim, set limits on what you're supposed to accomplish. Granting that there's a famous machloket about whether God prohibits kilayim only to Jews because actually the outcome is desirable, or whether the outcome is undesirable. I thought, so you could use that to claim that you have to make sure that whatever changes you make don't alter the species, don't create sterility. You could try to set objective markers like that, or more generally, you could try to claim that playing God is when you simply play with technologies that can have dramatic, drastic consequences without having really checked into what those consequences might be when there's so many variables in advance. But you could argue this is something that medicine has regularly breached. We try and learn from it in the past, from the cases where we were wrong, not to do it again, but you have the immediate pressure to heal, and you have no way of knowing whether the consequences of what you're doing, what those consequences will be in 30 years, because you'd have to wait 30 years to find out what the statistical impacts are. So this could also have broad implications that we're not really willing to abide by. But I guess what I would leave you with is that do you share the intuition that we can't really handle eugenics right now as such, that we can't just let people with CRISPR heal the same way we allow people at the same standards we allow people to use antibiotics? Do we want to distinguish between changes that solve specific diseases and changes that create characteristics that seem desirable in our society, whatever those may be, recognizing that what's desirable in one society may not? How specifically do we want to relate to notions of, I believe sex selection and PIG are different. I'm really just going to talk about mutations. Whether we think that the problem, right, so if you want to make a long, hard line between solving things that are obvious health problems and improving the species, do we want to just make a line about how careful you have to be before engaging in such things? And to some extent, do we want to make that halachic? And if we want to make it halachic, is the idea of playing God really a halachically feasible concept that's halachically feasible to apply, and or is kilayim a reasonable precedent? Okay, I think much work is necessary to do in that regard, and I hope that I'll have the opportunity to do that work in writing in the not distant future. But I want to talk about, in our last session together about this, is one other application that I wrote in an article for the Canopy Forum at Emory University some years ago, which is the question of physician-assisted suicide. What does halacha have to say about physician-assisted suicide? So you might say, you know, halacha thinks that if you take that position, right, there are two positions you can take that make the what halacha has to say about this obvious. One is to claim that halacha opposes suicide under all circumstances, and a variant of that claim is that halacha believes that human beings have no autonomy with regard to their bodies. Rav Zevin's famous position, and so obviously there are no circumstances under which you could choose suicide. I don't think either of those options are quite true. There are clearly cases where at least some positions in halacha permit suicide under some kinds of circumstances, maybe only extreme circumstances of torture. Rav Yechiel Yisraeli has a wild claim that this is true for non-Jews, but not for Jews. But if we're making a religious, you know, we're talking about what the role of assisted suicide in the culture generally, so that's the whole issue about how that should relate to Jews. And, you know, to probably we shouldn't ban things to the entire society that are only forbidden to Jews. And there's precedents from Shaul HaMelech about this as well. So I don't think that per se is the right answer. We can argue that physician assistance per se is a deep problem, because that's murder and not suicide, and that's also a very interesting claim. But as we noted earlier, halacha bans you from preventing the death of the goseh zman aruch, and maybe it even encourages you to assist it in circumstances where you can be entirely certain that the soul is imprisoned in the body and not inhabiting it. And at that point, the claim as to which point the soul is merely imprisoned in the body as opposed to inhabiting it is a religious claim, is the whole notion of a soul. And so at that point, it's not clear that that what we have to say Jewishly is genuinely participating in a fully public discussion. So two kind of issues: what would we say ourselves about halachically about it, and what do we think should be the public policy? So I wanted to argue that my chazit provides us with a useful public policy argument, because American society is facing, I think, a tension. The same sort of tension we dealt with in pre-life issues, which is that on the one hand, we think that suicide is a plague. We talk about often, right, about epidemic of suicides, particularly among young people. And we do, right, we have hotlines, we do all sorts of things in which we treat suicidality as a disease. And yet, on the other hand, we have movements for physician-assisted suicide. So how do we square the notion that suicide is a disease and a tragedy with the support for assisted suicide? So the answer to that, right, now the question is, right, should we allow that support for assisted suicide, which, you know, to be honest, is perhaps to some extent driven by the capacity of medical technology to preserve life beyond where it might be desired by the patient in many cases. But it might also be, right, that's a critique, it might also be the equivalent of, you know, various ancient cultures exposing the elderly because they slowed you down on a march or whatever it may be. Or because they could no longer contribute militarily, whatever it may be. So how do we draw the, right? It seems to me that the way in which American society squares this is really by saying, well, the lives of the young are more valuable than the lives of the extreme elderly. And that seems to me that, you know, that's where our first principle can come in and say, no, you can't do anything which implies that one life is more valuable than another. And to say that if you commit, right, that if you try to commit suicide when you're a person, when you're a person of type X, well, then we'll treat it as a disease. We'll even institutionalize you to prevent you from doing that. And if anybody attempts to assist you, we'll prosecute them afterwards for some form of homicide or manslaughter. But if you have, let's say the case of who want, you know, you have some kind of chronic illness, which is eventually going to kill you in an undignified fashion, so we'll allow you to die in it, to help you die in advance. So that seems to say that one form of life is more valuable than another. So legalizing assisted suicide is allowing either the doctor or society to claim that so long as we don't legalize suicide for everybody, so long as we, I think very, very appropriately, see suicide, right, see the desire to commit suicide as per se reflection of illness and something which has to be cured and prevented, so that allowing people to assist certain suicides and not others is a claim that some lives are more valuable than others, and therefore is a violation of our first principle. We're not talking about cases in any right where you might argue that life is a burden for the patient, because the whole point of a physician-assisted suicide, right, is not murder. It implies a situation where the person's life is still worth living, but you're doing it because you want them to have the choice to end their life while it is still valuable, as opposed to after it is no longer valuable. I want to argue that there was a second way of second argument that you could frame in these regards, that the argument here, the second argument is that legalizing assisted suicide is proper because it maximizes autonomy and dignity. And what you're saying, by allowing assisted suicide, is saying that the choices, this is the last meaningful choice you can make. And so really, the way I framed it was the counter-argument of the Jewish tradition is not that life is more valuable than autonomy and dignity, but that life derives its value, or the redness of its blood, from the capacity to choose, and that we ought not judge some opportunities to choose to be more valuable than others. Choosing death is a claim that all one's other choices are meaningless. In other words, that one's blood is no longer red at all, and assisting a suicide validates that claim. However, I have to acknowledge again that it's not true that Jewish tradition bans all suicide. And suicide is only possible at a stage which you can have choice. Right? So, right, we're not taught, right? That's a so it's always, anytime you approve a suicide, it's going to be a suicide in the context of depriving yourself of all future choices. So how do we square what I think is an argument from first principles that we should not be allowed to do this with a recognition that there are circumstances in which suicide can be legitimate. So I want to introduce here perhaps a more radical notion, and we'll close the series with that radical notion, which you can welcome feedback about. My suggestion is that we distinguish between legal ethics and case ethics. We distinguish between halakha and the right thing to do. More recently, I've been trying, you know, to put this very strongly in terms of Rav Soloveitchik's distinction between halakha and halachic morality, although I'm using it in a way that he would not have used it. Laws create general policies, right? This is a point I've always made. General policies always yield wrong outcomes in some cases. That's the nature of a general policy, is they have to ignore the details, and the details of there will always be details that would confound the rule. So I wanted to argue, however, right, that there's an interesting combination of those, which maybe there are some things that are the right thing to do, or that can be the right thing to do, only if they are done with full awareness that you can be legally punished for them. Right, what I call Jewish markers for that class include principles like sinning for the sake of heaven and zealots attack him. Right, sinning for the sake of heaven valorizes illegal actions engaged in to successfully achieve a greater good. Zealous attack him tolerates a kind of vigilante justice for some kinds of offenses. And I've argued that this is the best way to respond to what are called ticking bomb cases and torture. That I don't argue that torture is such a deontological wrong that if you were doing, right, if engaging in torture were the only way to prevent the nuclear destruction of an entire planet, that one would not allow to engage in torture. But the risk, of course, is that there'll be many, that in most of these cases, torture will not save the planet. Either you'll get wrong information, or there were other way, right, or there are other ways to do it. And so the only way to resolve this is by saying that torture is always illegal, even though we acknowledge that in rare cases it is proper, but it only becomes proper because it is illegal. And as a society, we will always have the obligation to assert the illegality, even in those cases, although we might choose not to punish for that illegality, because we recognize that that violation of the law was justified. The recognition that it's violation of the law is justified does not mean that it ought not to be the law. It just means that law is never perfect. Assisted suicide may fall into this category as well. The proper policy is to create an enormously powerful default in favor of the value of life. Legalizing assisted suicide has the effect of enlisting the state as a moral support for the decision for death. And therefore, of the proposition that the lives of some citizens are less valuable than those of others. So the irony is that if we legalize assisted suicide, that may mean that that may mean that it's always wrong morally. Whereas, so long as we kept it illegal, there might be circumstances in which it was morally justifiable. But legalizing it is a statement by the state that if you try to help this person commit suicide, that's murder. But if you try to help that person commit suicide, that's a mitzvah. Then you're obviously claiming that some lives are more valuable than others, and now you are in violation of a fundamental Jewish principle. Thank you very much for listening, and I hope that that this will turn into a much more rigorously formulated book soon, to which you've contributed by listening and through your comments, whether live or in writing. And I hope to explore in the not distant future some other first principles, not just the playing God principle, which we talked about briefly tonight, but also the notion of what I call living a normal life. And I hope that we'll have introduced several other principles by then as well. Thank you very much.